Our guest tonight on this special edition of Extension 720 is Michael York, the eminent actor. One sees him in all sorts of things, including great Agatha Christie adaptations in films. But I think, sir, you consider yourself essentially a Shakespearean, don't you?
Oh, I wouldn't say that. No, I mean, I've had this abiding love for Shakespeare, but I wouldn't like to limit myself to, you know, to him entirely.
But I'm going, of course, from the title of your new book, A Shakespearean Actor Prepares.
Yes, yes. In fact, someone said to me, you know, how can you, a Shakespearean actor, be in something like Austin Powers, which was a recent film, mm-hmm. which I must say seemed to have, judging from the response in the art museum this morning, it's certainly popular in Chicago. But my immediate response is, well, you know, Shakespeare would have loved Austin Powers. I mean, he had an even bawdier sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
No, I like to do everything.
The title of your new book, which you've done together with Adrian Brine, another eminent Shakespearean who, in fact, does most of his Shakespeare in languages other than English, doesn't he?
Which is very interesting.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, because you get a different response.
Of course you would.
And often translations, of course, they cut through the sort of veneer, the opaqueness of, you know, 400 years of change of language. So you get something. I've often wondered what it must be like to be German, seeing a Shakespeare in a modern translation.
Well, I remember the opening lines of the great To Be soliloquy, Sein oder nicht sein, so steht das Frage, I think. And you know it in French, don't you?
Well, être ou ne pas être, yes. But the wonderful thing is where you get the difference, for example, Lear's great cry, you know, how, you know, it's wonderfully onomatopoeic, is it doesn't really translate as well when you, I believe the Swedish is krik, 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 so you don't... And this is one of the key points we make,
yeah.
That, you know, he's using language. Language is, you know, character. The basis of our book is that it's from the actor-director's point of view, that whoever Shakespeare was, whether, you know, Warwickshire yokel or mm-hmm. nobleman with an acting troupe, he was essentially writing plays for actors, and he was doing three-quarters of the work for you because he was on your side.
And he was an actor who knew the needs of actors.
Well, we don't know who he was. There are all kinds of... There's the Stratford myth and there's other myths. I don't happen to believe the Stratford mythology holds up. You know, there are about four facts that we know on which this huge edifice of biography has been built.
You mean you are somewhat disposed towards... Shakespeare was really De Vere or one of those hypotheses?
I think the De Vere hypothesis is very, very compelling.
Oh, interesting.
Yes, but Adrian, my co-partner, doesn't agree. So I actually make this point, saying the one thing we're not going to argue about is mm-hmm. who was Shakespeare. because you could write, you know, whole volumes on this very issue.
Well, whole libraries have been written.
Indeed they have, yes. And yeah. We're all waiting for the smoking gun to be found, and it will in some obscure library, like the, you know, that the wonderful illustration of an Elizabethan theatre, which was found in the library in Utrecht in Holland,
mm-hmm. which is reproduced.
We reproduced it. It's the only illustration there is, and when Sam Wanamaker was rebuilding that good Chicagoan Sam was mm-hmm. rebuilding the Globe Theatre, you know, they also had the construction plans, Elizabethan construction, but they didn't know how legitimate they were. But that one illustration was key. And of course, in the first years when the theatre's been settling down, they've been experimenting with moving those pillars and, mm-hmm. You know, because the acoustics, of course, are key.
The title of the book that you and Adrian Brine have done is, of course, based upon the earlier book by Stanislavski, An Actor Prepares.
Well, it's a nod to Stanislavski, and that was deliberate. We had actually a bit of a fight, not just about Oxford, but about the title. Me and my, having lived in America, and my crass commercialism opted for Shakespeareans, mm-hmm. exclamation mark. That got, you know, frowned upon, and I think it was right, because the nod to Stanislavski in the title is deliberate. And the link between the two is, you know, it's there. Here were two great men of the theatre dealing with drama dealing with acting at that in their times that was frankly awful. Shakespeare creating a whole new kind of drama, and explicitly in Hamlet, through Burbage, through Hamlet, you know, pleading for a new naturalistic way of performing.
Yeah.
If you wanted to hear the old style, you would go around the corner to the Swan, where Edward Alleyn was holding forward with all his periwig-pated fellows.
Basic question posed in either a naive or a faux-naive way. Take two of your well-known film roles, namely Murder on the Orient Express and Romeo and Juliet. There are two performances. One is in a Shakespearean film. The other is, well, it's rather stylized and it's very delightful. It's based upon Agatha Christie. Is there a difference in how one would prepare for those two roles?
Do you know, I get into this. We have a chapter on Shakespeare on film. Obviously, an actor, you know, you're involved in the same kind of preparation. I think with film, you have to do a lot beforehand because very often you're filming the last scene first, on the very first day. Mm. So you have to do your homework. You're not allowed the luxury of planning things out. You know, if you're performing a play, you have, you know, 3-4 weeks, and you can let it slowly come to the boil. You can't afford to do that on film because they're rarely rehearsed. And I like the disordered momentum of film. Filming Shakespeare was interesting, and certainly with Romeo and Juliet, because it was able to address the paradox of Juliet, because, you know, Juliet is a 13-year-old child. On Lammas Tide shall she be 14? And you're dealing, you know, no actress or few actresses of those tender years can get their mind or their mouth round, you know, such sophisticated language. And in Romeo and Juliet, I mean, Shakespeare is just in love with those words, having this fabulous time. But on film, when you can break it down into little moments, little scenes, you can do it. And our Juliet, Olivia Hussey, was 16 at the time, 15, 16, and she manages beautifully. And the other half of the paradox, of course, is Lear. You know, Lear is 4 score and year and upwards, and few actors of those years can, you know, literally carry the role. As we mentioned, the advice of one great Shakespearean thespian who said, when asked about playing Lear, he said, "Get yourself a small Cordelia."
Yes. that's Donald Wolford.
Donald Wolford, exactly. One of our great thespians.
Interestingly, there's a wonderful film about a very Wolfert-like character on his last tour playing Lear.
The Dresser.
The Dresser.
Yes, that's... Yes, it's interesting, actually, how film... you know, the very early silent films, so many of them are drawn from Shakespeare, which strikes me as amazing, because when you're not hearing the language... and I think it sort of pays tribute to Shakespeare that he was capable of...
You know, I don't think I've ever seen a silent Shakespeare.
Well, there's a wonderful video of early Shakespeare, and there's some amazing things including, you know, hand-tinted versions of The Tempest.
Mm-hmm.
Very beautiful, and, you know, well worth reviving.
Of the whole range of roles and the whole set of plays, how many different plays have you done?
Really not as many as I'd like to. But, you know, hopefully, you know, there are opportunities in the future.
You're growing into Lear.
Yes, I'm heading that way.
Yeah. You've done a Hamlet, haven't you?
Yes.
Where did you do that?
I did that in London in the early 70s. And I had just come from America, and I mentioned it. It was America during the period of Vietnam, mm-hmm. when the country was... There was something rotten in the state, and you felt it, and it sort of infected the zeitgeist.
I'd love to get your reaction to and your judgment of some other actors, as well as, of course, I'm hoping to elicit from you a reading of one or two passages at least before we finish today. But here is Richard Burton in a celebrated production of Hamlet, the one that was, I believe, directed by Gielgud.
Oh, yes, in New York.
Yes. In New York.
Yes.
And we've chosen the gravedigger scene. And let's just 2 or 3 minutes of it, and then
wonderful.
I'd love to get your reaction to
it. What a treat.
How long will a man lie the Very rotten.
We're faith if it be not rotten afore a die, as we have many pocky courses nowadays that will scarce hold the laying in. It will last you some 8 year or 9 year. A tanner will last you 9 year.
Why he more than another?
Why, sir, his hide is so tanned with his trade it'll keep out water a great while. And your water is a sore decayer of your horse and dead body. Here's a skull now. This skull has lain in the earth 23 years.
Whose was it?
A horse and mad fellas it was. Whose do you think it was?
Nay, I know not.
A pestilence on him for a mad rogue. He poured a flag of the Rhenish on my head, but... This same skull, sir, was Yorick's skull. The king's jester.
This?
In that.
Let me... see. Alas, poor Yorick. I knew him, Horatio. A fellow of infinite jest, of most excellent fancy.
Ah.
He'd borne me in his back 1,000 times. And now, how abhorred in my imagination it is, my gorge rises at it. Here hung those lips that I've kissed, I know not how oft. Where be your jibes now? Your songs, your gambols, your flashes of merriment that were wont to set the table on a roar. Not one now to mock your own grinning, quite chop-fallen. Now get you to my lady's chamber and tell her, let her paint an inch thick. To this favor she must come. Make a laugh at that.
Burton's very distinctive.
Wonderful, but did you notice the way that both actors enunciated beautifully, giving the language true value?
Well, the one is in the equivalent of Cockney speech, whatever one would call it, but it's...
Yes, but even so, each word was given its due. Wonderful. I worked with Richard Burton on my first film.
Which one?
The Taming of the Shrew.
Oh, of course, yes.
Which he was a very wonderful Petruchio.
Yeah. A very mad Petruchio.
Yes. Yes, and one misses him.
Well, a gleefully mad Petruchio. I suppose you'd have to play it rather in that direction. But
I wish I'd seen his Henry V, which was the sort of talk of the old Vic in Stratford.
Is he a great actor?
Yes.
By every measure?
Yes, of course he is. Yeah. I mean, all this poppycock about selling out to the movies. I mean, it's just a strange kind of envy, as though, you know, as if anyone should presume to live someone else's life.
You mentioned Henry V. of course, the Henry V on film was originally the Olivier one, and then more recently Branagh did one. And
yes. Thank goodness he did, too.
Why?
Well, because... You know, my generation lived in the shadow of Olivier's films, and we thought that that's it, he'd put his stamp on them. It was the definitive thing. Mm-hmm. And of course, it was nonsense. You know, his Henry V was a film made in wartime, and he's a born winner, which is, you know, an example of how Shakespeare's plays miraculously reflect their times. And Branagh, you know, his version brings back all the self-doubt and the, you know, the torment and so on. Very appropriate for his time, too. Now the mold has been cracked, and it's very interesting, all these, you know, new interpretations. Ian McKellen's Richard III, you know, completely different and spectacular.
That's well worth talking about. In fact, I was able to extort from you a promise that you might read the opening... soliloquy from Richard III, and we have a recent Ian McKellen film along those lines. Let's go to that directly after we pause for these words. And we return to Michael York. We are drawing from a most interesting new book. Even a non-actor, as I am, has great pleasure reading A Shakespearean Actor Prepares by Adrian Brine and Michael York. That is just recently published by... Smith and Krause,
yes, who are a wonderful theatre book publishers in Hanover, New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm. They must be connected somehow to Dartmouth College, where I used to teach.
Well, indeed, right next door. In fact, we launched the book up in Hanover.
Did you?
And there was a little kind of thing at Dartmouth College. And best of all, I went over to the library at Dartmouth and looked at those first folios they had, and they let me turn the pages. And it vindicated something that I write about in the book, that these were plays written for actors. There you see, you know, in the original folios, you see commas and periods. That's all. None of this colons and whatever. Later editors have really kind of cleaned it up. You're seeing instructions for actors, where to breathe, where to stress. All the later editions look wonderful on the page, but they're not real help to
One of the great plays is Richard III. He does some considerable, Shakespeare does, distortion of the historical base.
Yes.
I suppose you argue that he does.
Oh, no, he does. In fact, all his history plays are not strict history. No. I mean, in fact, all of the plays operate on a level of, you know, myth. Allegory, fairy tale. I think that's why they survive. That's why they live. They have a sort of timeless quality, even the history plays.
Well, here we have consummate evil. There are one or two other purely evil figures in Shakespeare. Surely Iago is another. Who are the other perfect villains?
Well, you see, you don't ever get absolute evil. This is the fascinating thing.
Well, there's a fine point. Please develop it.
Yes. Well, he humanizes it. You know, if it was simply black and white, that would be too easy. But he doesn't, you know, he never takes a moral stand. And that's why his characters are so interesting. They're not types like Ben Jonson types. Or
Christopher Marlowe types.
Yes, exactly. They're much more interesting.
Actually, that point is so true. Obviously true once I hear you enunciate it again. It's visible even in that opening soliloquy of Richard III, where what is really invoked is the French dictum, tout comprenez, c'est tout pardonné. If you fully understand somebody, you can forgive him just about anything because there are reasons.
Exactly.
And here he's offering us the reasons why he's such a bastard.
I think the most dazzling piece of drama he sets himself is the wooing of Lady Anne over the body of her husband.
Yes.
And he pulls it off.
Yeah. What's that line? Was ever woman in such manner wooed?
Was so, man of one, yes.
I'll keep her, but not for long. But let's if you would, the opening lines of Richard III.
Yes. Now, this is from the book. Shakespeare perfected a style of writing that was not literary, but oral. A simple example would be enough to show how this oral style works. Let us look at the opening lines of Richard III. Now is the winter of our discontent made glorious summer by the sun of York, and all the clouds that lowered upon our house in the deep bosom of the ocean buried. If we change the order of two words only, the sense will not be altered. The winter of our discontent is now made glorious summer by this sun of York, and all the clouds that lowered upon our house buried in the deep bosom of the ocean. But all the life has gone out of it. It's like a flat tire. It has become a mere announcement, a piece of information. It starts before we are ready to listen, and it trails off at the end. The first and the last words make a mighty difference. The first word, now, is not only the opening word of the speech and the scene, but of the whole play. To see how this works in performance, we have to imagine a theatre with the audience abuzz with apprehension about the play they are going to see. A man steps onto the stage. There is opening music. Perhaps we don't know. Silence falls. Or the man silences the audience. He looks pleased about something. What? He starts to speak. Now! There's urgency in the word. He's not talking about yesterday or last week or even next week. It's now. A short, sharp word that bites. The ow sound will come back a few lines later. In clouds, lowered, our house. Now what? And our curiosity is fed spoonful by spoonful. A different layout will illustrate how. Now is the winter of our discontent made glorious summer by this sun of York. Sun, S-U-N, or sun, S-O-N. The listener hears both. With the summer comes the sun. The emblem that the House of York bore on their shields was that of a blazing sun. But the new king is also a son of the House of York. One word is thus doing the work of three. And all the clouds that lowered upon our house, the House of York, in the deep bosom of the ocean, We expect the next word to be melted or drowned or swallowed up or sunken, but Shakespeare surprises us. Buried. We notice the word all the more because we had to wait for it. The sentence was not complete without it. Buried suggests dead and gone forever, and the finality of burial is reinforced by making it the final word of the sentence. And what a gift for an actor, that plosive B of buried. Melted, sunken, or drowned would not give a like effect. After the lines, the audience is left with an image of an ocean with a clear horizon under a cloudless summer sky. The first word of the sentence, now, grabs us by the lapels and makes us listen. The sentence itself keeps us alert, in suspense, and the last word carries the most weight of all, dropping like a guillotine. The actor, if he felt so inclined, could leave a little pause after now and another before buried and still hold our attention. Oral style means shaping the sentence so that the actor can make the maximum effect. And well, there are further
it's a wonderful analysis
of that.
What would you do with the next few lines in the soliloquy? Grim-visaged war hath smoothed his wrinkled front, and instead of mounting barbed steeds to fright the souls of fearful adversaries, he capers nimbly in a lady's chamber.
To the lascivious pleasings of a lute.
Right, yeah.
And then he keeps changing. He keeps changing focus, keeps changing energy.
Then he gets self-indulgent, but I that am not shaped for sportive tricks.
No, that key word, but.
Yeah.
It happens in the sonnets, it's but yet. Yeah. It's where everything changes. It hinges on itself. Mm. And this is a key feature of Shakespeare. In fact, the sonnets personify it. You know, you have on the one hand A, on the other B, therefore C.
You're big on the monosyllables now, but...
Yes, but I think Shakespeare, as we say, makes but one of the most dramatic words in the language.
Mm.
And you wait for it, and it happens constantly. I'm going to tell you this, I'm going to tell you that, and then this. So thesis, antithesis, synthesis. And these 14 line, the 14-line structure, which is key to the sonnets, occurs, you know, elsewhere in nearly all the great speeches. So his mind is constant. It's always in dynamism. And in that opening speech, also, if you notice that the second half of the sentence carries greater weight, as in the sonnets, so it's always building. It's like a step. You're going up, and you're up, and you're up, and then but, and then you're turning in the other direction. It's wonderful.
How much have you done much directing of Shakespeare?
Not as much as I'd like, no.
Just listening to you, I have a sense that it would be a wonderful pleasure to be an actor directed by you in this other such play.
You know, one's got to that sort of age where you'd like to start giving it back. And this book was, you know, it came out of these letters that Adrian and I had written to each other. We had this old-fashioned habit of writing with pen and ink for 40 years. About what we were, especially about what we were doing with our professional lives, and we thought, well, someone suggested it. Maybe there's a book on acting that could be distilled from this collective wisdom. And we thought, well, you know, acting is acting. You do it, or you learn by doing it, and you get experience. But with Shakespeare, you needed something else. It's like, you know, climbing the mountain, you were better off if you had good boots and, you know, rope and maybe even a map. So that was the premise.
While we're talking, you draw so much out of the construction of the line and the construction of the image and the flow in Shakespearean verse. Here's another, a famous passage. This one, Ino Barbus' description of Cleopatra from Antony and Cleopatra. The actor is not known to me, but we had his name, Jack Gwilym.
Jack Gwilym.
Do you know him? Let's listen to this beautiful passage, and again, I'd be so fascinated to have your response both to the passage and to the performance.
Sure.
The barge she sat in, like a burnished throne, burned on the water. The poop was beaten gold, purple the sails, and so perfumed that the winds were lovesick with them. The oars were silver, which to the tune of flutes kept stroke, and made the water which they beat to follow faster, as amorous of their strokes. For her own person, it beggared all description. She did lie in her pavilion, cloth of gold, of tissue, or picturing that Venus where we see the fancy outwork nature. On each side her stood pretty dimple boys, like smiling cupids with divers colored fans, whose wind did seem to glow the delicate cheeks which they did cool, and what they undid did.
Oh, rare for Anthony.
Her gentlewomen, like the Nereides, so many mermaids tended her in the eyes and made their bends adornings. At the helm, a seeming mermaid steers. The silken tackles swell with the touches of those flower-soft hands that yearly frame the office. From the barge, a strange, invisible perfume hits the sense of the adjacent wharves. The city cast her people out upon her, and Antony, enthroned in the marketplace, did sit alone, whistling to the air, which but for vacancy had gone to gaze on Cleopatra too, and made a gap in nature.
Rare Egyptian.
Upon her landing, Antony sent to her, invited her to supper. She replied, it should be better, he became her guest, which she entreated. Our courteous Antony, whom ne'er the word of no woman heard speak, being barbered 10 times o'er, goes to the feast, and for his ordinary pays his heart for what his eyes eat only.
Wonderful. What a treat. But you notice, what I notice is that, you know, it's a poetical passage spoken by someone who's not, you know, in a barber's. He's
one of the generals.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. He's a soldier.
Yeah.
And the imagery is not highfalutin. It's not self-consciously poetical.
Mm-hmm.
He uses, and this is the key to Shakespeare, he uses everyday things, you know, lamps and lights and whatever. He's not like Marlowe, who will, you know, go on about the lamps of heaven, and they're, you know, very self-consciously highly wrought poetic words. That's what I love about Shakespeare. It's all drawn, you know.
It's interesting, even the most expressive of all writers in the English language, Shakespeare, uses the device of saying, I just can't describe it, it was so great. He says, for her person, it beggared all description.
Description, yes. Yeah.
No, it's, I can't describe
wonderful.
It.
Wonderful. Yes. Leaving a gap in nature.
Yeah.
I think it's...
What'd you think of the performance just then?
Good. I heard the words. And that's, for me, is the key to it. It's interesting, you know, we talked about the Globe, and I think we realize now that when the theaters were closed in 1642, that was a real dark day. Because what also closed and what we lost was this knowledge of that, the oral tradition, of how an actor, and those Elizabethan actors must have been something. They were, you know, acting to an audience of 3,000 people in daylight. So you have a, you know, a play about Hamlet, and you've got to convince these people that it's nighttime,
mm-hmm.
or it's foggy or whatever. And you've just got words to do it with. Mind you, you've got a great playwright assisting you. But I think with the reopening of the Globe, you know, we had to rediscover that sort of incredible dynamism that the actors used to have. And now, of course, everything's gone downhill because we're using, this instrument right in front of me, microphones and whatever. And I hear that they've just put microphones in the Olivia Theatre, the National Theatre in Britain. And I'm sure Olivia and Shakespeare are turning in their grave.
Just to project the sound, you mean?
Well, I suppose that, yes, to ginger it up a bit or...
Yeah.
I don't know, but, you know...
Who were the great Shakespearean actors of modern time, would you say?
Well, we've just lost one of the legendary ones, John Gielgud.
Yeah.
Who was, you know, I think his voice was incomparable as a most beautiful instrument. But again, not self-consciously beautiful. You know.
Years ago, that fellow Miller, what's his first name from the old Beyond the Fringe?
Jonathan Miller?
Jonathan Miller, of course, was here. And we were talking about acting, and he got off a line. We were talking about Shakespearean performance. He said, well, there was the old manner, Gielgud's manner, the warble of Gielgud, he said. But we've gone beyond that.
I disagree with him.
He was mocking it just a bit.
Yes, I disagree. You know, I think a lot of our present actors could do with some
I love yoga.
Training, in voice production. And it's not a question of bringing out the music in the verse. I think Shakespeare would have hated that. But of giving the words their justice.
Yeah.
Because they are what's doing it all for you. They're telling you where you are, as I said, our premise was that within the plays themselves, there were the keys to how, Shakespeare wanted them interpreted.
Mm-hmm.
And this whole question of interpretation, gets horribly in the way. So our premise was what the written material brings to the actor, not what the actor brings
that
to the material.
That raises a very interesting question. In fact, something that bothers me a great deal about Shakespeare in the modern day and in the modern theater, which I shall disclose and to which I shall seek your response right after we pause for these words. We return to Michael York, whose credits I haven't gone over, but everybody remembers Michael York, including, of course, you in The Three Musketeers. Now, you are D'Artagnan, are you not?
That's right, yes.
Yeah, so you're really the fourth musketeer
yes.
of the three.
Yes.
And so many wonderful films. But let me return to the question of Shakespearean performance and Shakespearean production, one might say.
Yes.
We're drawing from your book, A Shakespearean Actor Prepares. That's by Michael York and Adrian Brine, and is just recently published by Smith and Kraus. A wonderfully engaging book, even if you are not, surely if you are not an actor, as well as if you are. If you love Shakespeare at all, and what person in reasonable mind would not if he knew any Shakespeare, will get tremendous delight from reading this very intelligently organized, very intelligently sounded book about Shakespearean performance, which is really also a tremendous appreciation of Shakespeare as our greatest writer in the English language. I was promising you a complaint before. My complaint is simply about all those modern productions, whether on stage or on film, in which they update or take Shakespeare out of the time. That doesn't bother me necessarily. When I was a boy in New York, I saw a wonderful production of Hamlet organized by and performed by Maurice Evans,
mm-hmm.
placing it sort of in the 19th century with a lot of the finery of sort of old Vienna, I think, or something of that sort. But the odd modernistic readings, there's a film just out, I've not seen it. It's been rather heavily panned, I think, by most reviewers, in which they've put Hamlet on Madison Avenue.
Oh, no, I saw it. Ethan Hawke's Hamlet
with
the Denmark Corporation. I liked it.
I thought
Amerita pulled it off.
Ah.
But there are other films. I think, sometimes we're a little too respectful of Shakespeare, and he would have hated that. I think it's really whatever worked. But again,
surely you've seen some that don't work at all.
Oh, yes,
and are so
painful. There's nothing worse.
As for example?
Well, and I'm not going to be rude. I know how difficult it is. I know that everyone who makes a film, you set out with the greatest of intentions. No. You want it to work, and somehow this, sometimes the mixture rises, sometimes it doesn't. It's as Shakespeare knew, mm-hmm. these things are not predictable. But I think you have to, you don't treat him as a monument, because monuments honor the dead, and he's very much alive, but you treat him with respect, and you give the verse justice. I mean, I've seen, Romeo and Juliet set, using guns and so on, and they're terrific, and the chorus is a TV set.
We have West End Story.
Yeah.
But Bernstein's musical, which is based upon Romeo and Juliet.
Sure, but I don't mind at all. I think, phony Elizabethan clothes make for heavy performances.
Oh, really?
But I want to hear the verse. I want to hear the words.
Speech, the speech I pray you?
Yes. That's the key to it.
As I pronounced it to you, trippingly upon the tongue. What does trippingly mean in that context?
Heavily.
Do not mouth our words, as some
of
your players do. Yeah.
Which is one of the great acting lessons ever given, and still absolutely relevant. He was creating something extraordinary. And, within the plays, he tells us how he wants it done. And I think we should respect that.
Of all the plays, which I'll do a version of the cliche desert island question. If you only could take along a few actors with you and you're going to be marooned for the rest of your life on a desert island, which one Shakespearean play would you want to bring along so that you could act it?
Well, it should be, of course, something one doesn't know very well, so you get to love it, like Pericles or even Titus. But I think Hamlet is inexhaustible. I mean, if you had to choose one, I think it's the ultimate existential, questions. What are we doing? Why are we here? And where are we going?
How did you solve that? Or how did you go at that when you played Hamlet? How did you motivate Hamlet?
He was a very much... I was quite young then. He was a young prince. He was rather aristocratic. We made it... the director was Joseph O'Connor, a wonderful Irish playwright.
Mm-hmm.
So he was interested in the sort of Christian aspects, and they are there, of course. It's one of the underpinnings of the play. I mean, Claudius would be the only time when he actually falls on his knees and confesses about his crime. Otherwise, you'd have this perfectly decent court with this totally mad prince making all these. accusations. Of course, once you've done Hamlet once, you feel you've just scraped the surface and you long to do it again. And of course, the other thing, it never goes away with most Shakespeare plays. They don't. They stick in the mind. Maybe it's the way they're written. They're infinitely memorable and they just stay with you.
We've only got about 5 minutes left, and we've got to get you free to go to another engagement. I much appreciate your taking this time with us. And although I wasn't planning this because I wasn't expecting the surprise that you put on the table when we first began, I cannot resist picking you up once again on your assertion earlier that you are a De Verean, that you don't really believe that Will Hamlet, the Glover's son from Stratford, was Will Shakespeare, the Glover's son from Stratford, was the real Shakespeare.
Well, I'm not a dyed-in-the-wool Oxfordian, but I think it's a pretty interesting premise.
But you're apparently dyed-in-the-wool with the certainty or the conclusion that whoever he was, it wasn't the fellow from Stratford.
It seems unlikely that a man who is in his will, is almost barely sign his name, has no books, his wife is illiterate, his daughter's illiterate, nobody, when he dies, nobody mentions it. It just doesn't add up. This, small, crab, litigious mind doesn't square with the great Renaissance mind.
How do we know it to be a small, crab, litigious mind?
Well, from his
from
will,
the will.
All this about, he was endlessly...
Leading his bed to some...
Yes, and all, thoroughly a nasty man. Whereas Oxford fits the bill to perfection.
The Earl of Oxford, explain who he was.
He was Edward de Vere, the 17th Earl of Oxford, one of the great princes of the realm, who translated Ovid, Metamorphosis, a genius. We bandy this word, and the Stratfordians, their answer is, well, he was a genius, as though this covered everything. But I think de Vere was. He'd been to France, to Italy, all those places that are written about. He had knowledge of the law, of all those aristocratic pursuits like falconry and the endless images, in the plays. But what's he doing with the theatre, which is a sort of the realm of rogues and vagabonds? You had to cross the Thames to the bear baiting and the prostitution, to see plays. It wasn't done. And no great prince of the realm could be associated with the plays, which some of them also are pretty inflammatory, in terms of their comment on, on kingship, what's going on in England. And I think this is a pretty good premise. They're written under a pseudonym. And as his family crest is a lion shaking a spear, it's not Shagsbur, which is the Warwickshire. It's shake-spear. And somehow everything's got very confused, but don't tell the good citizens of Stratford on Avon, because they'll be sending their writs to me right now.
What role do the sonnets have in this argument?
Well, the key thing. Now, what on earth was this Warwickshire yokel writing these very kind of intimate poems to an aristocrat? It's just unthinkable. But when you have an even greater peer writing to a younger one, and someone who was also homosexual, bisexual, whatever, it takes on this absolutely inflammatory, revelationary dimension.
Who are the scholars who are on the De Verean side?
Oh, there are lots of them. And they have conferences, and they write books, and there's a newsletter, and it's very, very interesting. I joined the Shakespeare Oxford Society because I thought it was such a fascinating concept. And the light that it sheds on the plays. And usually when these things are debated, it's the Oxfordians win hands down.
Do you think holding that view would in any way, or has in any way, affected your Shakespearean performances?
Not at all. Maybe it has, when you realize that Hamlet is almost autobiographical if you see it in Oxfordian terms. Yes, it's piqued interest. It's the most wonderful field to explore. And as I said, I do it because I love to keep the doors and windows open, you know, and entertain this prospect.
Well, you do it wonderfully well. You make a good argument, and of course, as well, you've got a wonderful appreciation for Shakespeare and a great gift in conveying that appreciation, all of which is evident in the book by Adrian Brine and Michael York, A Shakespearean Actor Prepares, which has just recently been published. And I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed this.